been in contact with someone who's tested positive. Self-isolation is important. Please, take it seriously. Learn more at quebec.ca/self-isolating. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! President Trump reveals he and the First Lady have both tested positive for COVID-19 and are entering 14 days of quarantine. This comes just days after Trump mocked his presidential rival Joe Biden for wearing masks.
I don't wear masks like him. Every time you see him, he's got a mask. He could be speaking 200 feet away from it. He shows up with the biggest mask I've ever seen.
For months, President Trump has downplayed the severity of the pandemic, which has killed over 206,000 Americans.
It's giving them a false sense
right
of security.
Now, I think it's under control. I'll tell you what.
How? 1,000 Americans are dying a day.
They are dying. That's true. And it is what it is. But that doesn't mean we aren't doing everything we can. It's under control as much as you can control it. This is a horrible plague that beset us.
We'll speak to two leading doctors and look at how the news could reshape the presidential race. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Donald Trump has announced he and First Lady Melania Trump have COVID-19, joining 7.3 million people across the United States who've tested positive for the novel coronavirus since the first recorded U.S. case in January. Just before 1 a.m. Eastern Time Friday, Trump tweeted, "Tonight, FLOTUS and I tested positive for COVID-19. We will begin our quarantine and recovery process immediately. We will get through this together," Trump wrote. The stunning announcement rattled world capitals and set off fears the president of the United States may be at the center of a super spreader event in the halls of power in Washington, D.C., and at several recent gatherings headlined by Trump. Those include a campaign fundraiser at Trump's Bedminster Golf Club on Thursday, a campaign rally in Duluth, Minnesota on Wednesday, attended by thousands of Trump supporters, and Tuesday night's presidential debate with Joe Biden in Cleveland, Ohio, sponsored by the Cleveland Clinic. CNN reports Joe Biden is being tested for coronavirus this morning over fears President Trump may have infected him at the debate, where the candidates stood about 10 feet apart, not wearing masks. President Trump spoke loudly and incessantly through most of the 90-minute event, interrupting Biden 128 times.
I don't wear masks like him. Every time you see him, he's got a mask. He could be speaking 200 feet away from it. He shows up with the biggest mask I've ever seen.
Tuesday's indoor debate was attended by former Second Lady Dr. Jill Biden, who wore a mask throughout the evening. First Lady Melania Trump and all four of President Trump's adult children removed their masks after they were seated. A Bloomberg reporter at the debate says Trump's family members refused when a doctor at the Cleveland Clinic offered them masks. Trump's announcement early Friday that he has COVID-19 came only after Bloomberg News reported that Hope Hicks, one of Trump's closest advisors, became ill during Trump's Wednesday night rally at Duluth, Minnesota, and had to be quarantined aboard Air Force One on the return flight to Washington. Hope Hicks went on to test positive for coronavirus early on Thursday, though the White House did not report her illness. A number of reporters who were with Hicks and the president on the flight say no one from the White House reached out to them to perform contact tracing or to inform them of their risk of COVID-19. One HuffPost reporter was visibly shaken after learning of Hicks' positive test result from news reports. On Thursday afternoon, President Trump proceeded to his golf resort in Bedminster, New Jersey, for a campaign fundraiser where he delivered a speech while wearing no mask, coming in close contact with dozens of staffers and campaign supporters. The New York Times' Maggie Haberman reports aides who would normally travel with the president did not go with him to Bedminster because they already knew about Hope Hicks' positive test result. Among those aides who didn't go on the plane was White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany, who made no mention of Hicks' illness or her recent close contact with Hicks as she spoke to reporters for 25 minutes from the White House press briefing room podium while wearing no mask. Trump's positive result has raised concerns about the line of succession. Vice President Mike Pence met with Trump at a White House coronavirus task force briefing on Monday. President Trump is 74 years old, has elevated blood pressure, is over the threshold for obesity, three factors linked to higher morbidity and mortality among COVID-19 patients. Early in the pandemic, Trump publicly downplayed the severity of COVID-19, publicly claiming the virus would go away like a miracle, even as he privately told journalist Bob Woodward it was airborne and far deadlier than the flu.
This thing is a killer if it gets you. If you're the wrong person, you don't have a chance.
Yes, yes, exactly. This is a monster. This is a scourge. And
it is the plague.
The U.S. recorded another 46,000 cases of coronavirus Thursday and nearly 850 deaths, raising the official U.S. death toll to more than 208,000. On Thursday, before the president announced he'd tested positive for coronavirus, the Trump campaign said it was moving ahead with two rallies this weekend in Wisconsin, even though the White House Coronavirus Task Force has labeled Wisconsin a red zone with a high rate of community spread. Those plans are now in disarray. Trump's campaign has canceled plans for tonight's rally in Orlando, Florida. In New Hampshire, former South Carolina governor and Trump campaign surrogate Nikki Haley hosted an event Thursday for 99 Republican women running for office. Haley tweeted a photo of herself posing with the women packed indoors, shoulder to shoulder. None of them wearing masks. Here in New York, the John F. Kennedy Jr. School in Queens sent students home for 2 weeks after staff members tested positive for coronavirus. This came on the first day of in-person classes for many of New York City's half a million students, even as 10 zip codes in Brooklyn and Queens reported alarming spikes in coronavirus cases. Amazon Thursday released data showing nearly 20,000 of its workers have tested positive or were presumed to have COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic. In sports news, the Tennessee Titans canceled Sunday's game with the Pittsburgh Steelers after the team's total number of confirmed coronavirus cases rose to 11. In Texas, Republican Governor Greg Abbott issued a proclamation Thursday limiting absentee ballot drop-off locations to just one per county in the latest effort by Texas Republicans to make it more difficult for people to vote, especially in urban areas home to a greater proportion of Democrats. Abbott's proclamation leaves 4.5 million residents of Harris County with just a single location to drop off their completed ballots. This is Myrna Perez, director of the Brennan Center's Voting Rights Program.
We're obviously concerned that any additional barrier to the ballot box are going to hurt those members of our community that have been traditionally disenfranchised. Poor folks, people of color, students, folks who traditionally have had a harder time overcoming the kind of barriers that have been placed in front of them systematically.
In Michigan, conservative hoaxers and conspiracy theorists Jacob Wohl and Jack Berkman face four felony charges over robocalls targeting black voters in Detroit and other cities. The recorded messages falsely claim that voting by mail could subject voters to arrest, debt collection, and forced vaccination. In Pennsylvania, Republican lawmakers have advanced a state resolution that would create a so-called Select Committee on Election Integrity that Democrats warn could be used to disrupt the November 3rd election by giving Republicans the power to subpoena election officials even before all the votes are counted. On Wednesday, Democratic State Representative Malcolm Kenyatta blasted Republican plans at a committee meeting in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
This, I guess we're calling it Committee on Election Integrity, has no integrity, has none. And what it would do, and you can laugh, Representative, but what it would do is allow people, allow the folks on this committee that are actively up for re-election to subpoena ballots, to subpoena elections officials during an election of which they are participants. Nothing about that screams of integrity.
Last week, The Atlantic magazine revealed Republican Party officials are looking at ways to subvert the election process to ensure Trump stays in power, including a plan to have Republican-led state legislatures claim the results of the election to be fraudulent, then choose a slate of Republican electors to vote in the Electoral College regardless of the outcome of the actual vote. President Trump Thursday said he disavowed the Ku Klux Klan and white supremacy in an interview with Fox News' Sean Hannity.
I condemn the KKK. I condemn all white supremacists. I condemn the Proud Boys. I don't know much about the Proud Boys, almost nothing, but I condemn that.
Trump's comment came 2 days after Tuesday's debate, where he told the far-right Proud Boys organization, which is described by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group, to, quote, stand by.
Call them. Give me a name. Give me a
white
name.
Supremacists and
would you like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right Proud Boys.
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by.
The Proud Boys are now selling T-shirts with the president's words, stand back and stand by. On Thursday, a Proud Boys leader told CNN he's also the leader of the grassroots group Latinos for Trump. The Trump administration has ordered federal law enforcement officials to publicly defend Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old charged with fatally shooting two protesters in Kenosha, Wisconsin, during Black Lives Matter protests in August. That's according to internal Department of Homeland Security talking points obtained by NBC News. The documents instruct federal agents to say Rittenhouse took a gun to Kenosha to, quote, help defend small business owners. Last week, Rittenhouse's mother, who drove her son across state lines with an AR-15 assault rifle to the Kenosha protests, received a standing ovation at a Republican Party event in Wisconsin. If convicted of first-degree murder charges, Rittenhouse faces up to life in prison. Vice News reports police in Pearland, Texas, requested the presence of Border Patrol snipers at George Floyd's burial June 9th and gave them permission to use deadly force as members of the militarized tactical unit known as BORTAC surveilled funeral attendees. Records obtained by Vice also reveal an FBI surveillance aircraft was flown over the burial to monitor for so-called violent, quote, agitators. That day, at least six sniper teams were in place on rooftops and authorized to open fire. A secretive religious group has scrubbed its website of all references to President Trump's nominee to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. Amy Coney Barrett is a longtime member of the Catholic group People of Praise, whose members pledge a lifelong loyalty oath assigning each member a personal advisor known as Heads for Men and, until recently, Handmaids for Women. People of Praise has a strictly patriarchal structure in which men are the heads of household with power over their wives and families. Senate Republicans have promised a swift confirmation process for Amy Coney Barrett. On Thursday, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany was pressed by reporters after she falsely claimed Barrett was a recipient of the prestigious Rhodes Scholarship from Oxford University.
You said Judge Barrett was a Rhodes Scholar. I'm not sure that that's true.
That's what I have written
here. She attended Rhodes College.
Attended Rhodes College. So my bad.
Very different.
House Democrats on Thursday passed a $2.2 trillion coronavirus relief bill, sending the slimmed-down aid package to the Senate more than 4 months after they passed the $3.4 trillion HEROES Act. Senate Republicans refused to vote on the previous bill, and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has signaled he will not vote on the revised HEROES Act either. This comes as the Census Bureau show 10% of U.S. households report they sometimes or often did not have enough to eat within the past 7 days, with nearly one in five Black and Latino households affected. Meanwhile, anti-hunger activists around the United States are denouncing a letter written in English and Spanish and signed by President Trump, placed in food assistance boxes doled out to food banks nationwide. They're denouncing the letter as a violation of the Hatch Act, which prohibits federal employees from using government property for partisan political gain. In New York, over a dozen housing activists were arrested Thursday as hundreds of protesters took to the streets demanding local lawmakers take action on a full eviction moratorium and tenant protection during the pandemic. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has failed to extend a pandemic eviction ban, which expired yesterday as rent came due. In immigration news, over 3,000 people fled Honduras yesterday in a caravan with the hopes of reaching the United States. This comes just days after the region reopened its borders after months of a strict coronavirus lockdown that left thousands without jobs, sinking further into poverty. The caravan made it to Guatemala yesterday afternoon, where they headed north to the border with Mexico. The Guatemalan president, Alejandro Giammattei, announced he'd ordered the immediate apprehension of caravan members. Meanwhile, the Mexican government threatened asylum seekers with prison time if they enter Mexico without following proper health protocols, citing alleged concerns due to the pandemic. CNN has released audio recordings of First Lady Melania Trump in 2018 dismissing the harm of separating asylum-seeking families at the U.S.-Mexico border. Stephanie Winston Wolkoff recorded the comments while working on her book, Melania and Me, about her relationship with the First Lady.
You know, who gives a f*** about Christmas stuff and decoration, but I need to do it, right?
Yeah, but 100%. You have no choice.
And okay, and then I do it, and I say that I'm working on Christmas, planning for the Christmas, and they said, oh, what about the children that they were separated? Give me a break. Where they were saying anything when Obama did that?
In Colombia, renowned historian and leftist political leader Campo Elias Galindo was found shot to death in his apartment in the city of Medellin. Galindo long advocated for social justice and peace in Colombia. He was 69 years old. And the New Yorker magazine reports former Fox News paid up to $4 million to settle sexual harassment claims made by a staffer to former anchor Kimberly Guilfoyle. The former assistant claims Guilfoyle showed her lewd images of men's genitals, forced her to work at Guilfoyle's apartment, where Guilfoyle would sometimes be naked. In July 2018, Guilfoyle abruptly left her position as co-host of Fox News' The Five. She now serves as President Trump's campaign finance chair and is the partner of Donald Trump Jr. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
I chose to be here, and I always regret decisions that I make that I can't blame on someone else. I never thought I'd be caught in any way, in a place or with a person. Can I leave my options open? I can't seem to tunnel vision, my love. And I can't predict what would happen. If I saw you again, I might sit back in. If I go, or if I stay, my heart and their hearts are breaking anyway. If I try to navigate, horizon as far as it comes, but I feel so alone. You were always looking around, unsatisfied with the love that we found, but I wonder where you are now. And it's complicated, 'cause he's so amazing. He gives me so much love, but I'm thinking, oh, you're touching your skin, so different than him. If I go, or if I stay, my heart and their hearts are breaking anyway. If I try to separate, breaking anyway. If I try to navigate my love, my heart and their hearts are breaking anyway. If I go, or if I stay, my heart and their hearts are breaking anyway. If I try to separate my love, my heart
I don't think we can ever talk about something turning violent. We are already always in a violent state of affairs if we still need to cry out Black Lives Matter. If fascists are allowed to march while chanting Jews will not replace us, like, don't talk to me about turning violent. The violence is there in the DNA of the situation.
Journalist Natasha Leonard is no stranger to protests, including the Black Lives Matter uprisings that have taken off this summer across the U.S. Those protests have become a backdrop to the 2020 election as President Donald Trump runs as a law and order candidate, literally. He's tweeted out "law and order" in all capital letters multiple times since the protests began. And to make his case, he's returning to a familiar foe.
You know, they show up in the helmets and the black masks, and they've got clubs and they've got everything. Antifa!
Antifa. Antifa, as in anti-fascist. Trump has mentioned Antifa a lot over the last few years, but now it seems to be reaching a fever pitch as the election gets closer. Antifa seems to be more and more portrayed as enemy number one, a shadowy cabal of leftists keen on taking over the U.S. So where did that perception come from, and what is Antifa really? I'm Malika Bilal, and this is The Take.
They call themselves Antifa, known to not only clash with bigots, but also sometimes with police and occasionally storefronts.
These guys show up in black masks with clubs, and they want to confront people, and they want to agitate, and they want the headlines.
Does anybody want to have somebody from Antifa as a resident of your suburb? I don't think so. Too much.
I think if you only consumed mainstream and establishment media, you would get the impression that Antifa was a huge, very well organized, connected group committed to chaotic harm without any sort of social or racial justice undergirding in mind. That's certainly the impression that the Trump administration has committed to painting of Antifa. They have made Antifa the boogeyman of their re-election campaign.
Natasha is a columnist at The Intercept and author of the book Being Numerous, Essays on Non-Fascist Life. Perhaps not surprisingly, she is an anti-fascist herself. And that's why we wanted to talk to her. There's a lot of talk about Antifa, but you don't often hear from someone who identifies with it. We asked her to list some of the biggest misconceptions that she often sees. The first, that Antifa is even a group.
A dangerous, violent group.
Is the world finally waking up to the threat posed by Antifa and similar groups?
Don't you get the sense that there's some individual or individuals who are centrally organizing this?
First and foremost, there is no one big organization called Antifa with membership, leadership, some sort of central committee. A historian in the US, Mark Braid, says, think of it like bird watching. There's obviously not one big organization of bird watching TM, but it's an activity with a certain set of practices that numerous groups can pick up, take up, and engage in.
We'll dig into those tactics later, but first, misconception number two. Antifa practitioners are aimless agents of chaos.
Fires, property damage, hand-to-hand combat at protests across the country.
These are leftists who frankly hate America, who want to overthrow it, happy to take on anyone else who stands for the flag or traditional values in this country.
It's certainly not chaos for chaos's sake. It's a very focused type of disruptive action that aims to take any oxygen away from the organizing far right by quite physically breaking up rallies or shutting down when far right neo-Nazi and white supremacist speakers gather to speak. And that can involve property damage, and that can also involve physical confrontation, but it's almost always very, very targeted with an increasingly emboldened far right.
As other anti-fascists have put it, it's about self-defense.
When fascists come to our city to attack people, we are going to put our bodies between fascists and the people they want to attack and try to prevent them from doing that.
Now, the images of property damage and street fights that are often associated with Antifa, well, there's truth to them. But Natasha says it's worth looking at the numbers when it comes to deadly violence. The Anti-Defamation League actually does this. They track and categorize what they call domestic extremist killings. And their numbers show that the far right is actually responsible for more lives lost than any other extremist category it tracks, including what it calls the far left. For those two, it's about 330 to 13 over the last 10 years up through 2019.
In the last 10 years, far-right militia members, individual white supremacists and white supremacist groups are responsible for over 75% of extremist killings. So the misconception that the left is somehow a greater threat to life or liberty really depends which lives you think get to matter.
And a leaked intelligence assessment by the Department of Homeland Security has even identified, quote, white supremacist extremists, unquote, as the foremost threat to the U.S. elections. And that's a key part of Antifa, the anti in the anti-fascism. For as long as fascism has existed, so has anti-fascism.
Antifa is more of a political practice that has existed for about 100 years, certainly since the left-wing groups that fought Mussolini's and Hitler's supporters a century ago.
The term was first used by a communist group in Germany, dating back to before World War II. And while many people are not exactly pro-fascism, that doesn't mean that everyone against it is actively fighting it. As Natasha put it, you can't reason your way out of fascism. It's not an ideology with a purely rational appeal. She says it has to be confronted.
So I would love us all to be Antifa, but we are not all militantly anti-fascist. One would hope that we are all willing to stand up and fight fascism in all its forms. We do want that. But there is something specific about Antifa that is a set of practices with a specific history, and it is really, it's militant anti-fascism.
When Natasha says militant, she doesn't necessarily mean physically confrontational. That disruption takes place in different ways. But it all falls along the lines of confronting far-right organizing.
the spread of tactics that Antifa takes up are broader than I think mainstream media would have you believe, because obviously attention is put on Antifa when there is physical confrontation. But most of the work is research. It's in fact incredibly nerdy. So a lot of it is online doing the really unpleasant work of being in far right specific online communities in order to find out which fascist groups are organizing and making it public that someone in your neighborhood is organizing neo-Nazi and informing their employers. Things like that that make it more and more impossible to organize with the anonymizing safety of the internet that a lot of neo-fascists do rely upon.
No one's paying attention to them. And sooner or later, they're going to be your police officers. They're going to be your politicians. They're going to be your teachers. They are going to be people that you cannot touch. And I don't want that to happen.
Or, as The Daily Show put it, Antifa is doing for society what women do for their friends.
You know, it's like, girl, I know he seems normal, but there's something you should know about him. He's a Nazi who never calls back when he says he will.
Then, of course, you also have very public fascists, probably the most famous in recent years to get a real platform, who has lost some standing now, I think, thanks to Antifa interventions, the neo-Nazi Richard Spencer.
Richard Spencer would prefer to be called alt-right, a term that he famously coined. If the misconceptions of Antifa have an origin story, he's part of it, and he was there for several key moments. He's one of those guys in a suit, with his hair short on the sides, long on the top, making white supremacy dapper again. And he gained some traction on CNN and the Los Angeles Times, and with his own massive audience on social media. But he doesn't have the platform he once did.
He had tens of thousands of followers on Twitter. So just as an example, getting his platforms removed, him and those of his ilk, is a huge amount of Antifa work, which, you know, members of the public who aren't often involved in Antifa organizing take part in too, you know, which is hardly radical, right? Pointing out to a social media company that their hate speech rules are being violated. But drawing attention to those figures and trying to shut those down is as much Antifa work as taking a punch to a neo-Nazi.
That punch, back in 2017, was the first encounter many Americans had with Antifa on their screens. If you didn't know Richard Spencer as the dapper Nazi before then, you might have heard of him around Trump's inauguration, when an anti-fascist punched him in the face in the middle of an interview.
No, I'm not a neo-Nazi.
Do you like black people?
He's being interviewed on camera and being harassed by a group of activists explaining the green frog pin on the lapel of his suit. When
are you like the hipster version of the neo-Nazi movement?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
We still don't know who actually threw the punch, because the person was masked and wearing all black. That signaled their participation in another notable anti-fascist action that day, a disruptive march against Trump's inauguration. There was video of smashed windows and a limousine burning.
Police in riot gear facing off against the protesters just 6 blocks from the inaugural parade.
Natasha was there too, participating.
The protest was, I think, a specific gesture to the fact that we see Trump as an explicitly fascist force. If we engage in that repertoire of protest, we're saying we recognize the thing we are opposing as fascist.
But from those first days of the Trump administration, there have been consequences for participating in these kinds of anti-fascist actions. At that demonstration, police made mass arrests of protesters and journalists alike.
Multiple felony and misdemeanor charges, including inciting or urging to riot, conspiracy to riot, and multiple counts of destruction of property.
Many of the defendants were on trial for more than a year, facing down decades in prison. But eventually, all of them were either acquitted or had their charges dropped. But while the inauguration protesters were on trial for property damage, Richard Spencer was helping to organize the largest white supremacist gathering in decades. The Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in 2017.
You will not replace us!
It was a big moment for anti-fascists, too. Locals had prepared counter-protests. And then...
the car just plowed through hundreds of people downtown Charlottesville.
The driver is identified as James Alex Field. Just before the attack, Fields was caught chanting a message of white power.
That attack killed one counter-protester, Heather Heyer, and injured dozens of others. But despite the white supremacist violence, the whole weekend became another flashpoint in the American understanding of Antifa.
I think a lot of people felt that surely everyone would just decry this and all those kind of veiled, euphemistic, almost fascisms would be masked off, revealed for what they are.
That's not what happened. After Charlottesville, one of the main takeaways from Donald Trump was famously that there were
very fine people on both sides.
But anti-fascists continued counter-protesting at rallies, raising hell at white supremacist speeches, and creating a general atmosphere of confrontation and disruption. Meanwhile, violence from the far right seemed to soar.
There has been a shooting at a synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Oregon State Police are warning lawmakers to stay away from the Capitol because of threats from militias.
Hispanic Americans say they are fearful after the mass shooting in El Paso. A racist manifesto posted online before the shooting claimed, quote, "This attack is a response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas."
So fast forward to today. There's been more than 100 days of sustained protests around the country following high-profile police killings of Black people.
You know, within days of the current anti-racist uprisings, the swiftness with which the Trump administration and then many others in the media were willing to say, these aren't somehow organic and justified uprisings in any way. The property damage, the rebellious nature can only be explicable by talking about anarchists and Antifa coming in and burning things down. The fact that numerous protesters are willing to take militant action right now, it kind of makes it readily available for Trump to say, actually, this is not anything legitimate. This is just outside agitator Antifa.
Here's U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr making that same case.
In many places, it appears the violence is planned, organized, and driven by anarchic and left extremist groups using Antifa-like tactics, many of whom travel from outside the state to promote the violence.
Natasha says there's several problems with that.
First of all, it delegitimizes Black-led uprisings. I don't think those sort of protests are only justified if people mourn and march politely.
Also, Natasha says, just because a mass anti-racist uprising is using confrontational tactics, and just because the government is conflating it with Antifa, it doesn't mean that everyone in the streets identifies with that label, even when there are anti-fascist protesters there too.
It would be a kind of category mistake to say every time you see a window broken, that was Antifa. Every time you see people dressed in all black, that was Antifa. Because that's just sort of technically not true in terms of how groups self-identify. And we don't want to forget the important legacy of Black liberation struggle. And that comes from a very different historical legacy than the European history of anti-fascism. Even if the ideology being opposed, that of genocidal white supremacy, is the same.
But that complexity in how protesters identify themselves often gets lost. Natasha says to much of the media and the public, what the protests are about is less important than whether they turn violent.
You see it often in media narratives around protests that are rebellious or disruptive. You hear about the violent turn. The protesters turned violent.
The nation already on edge as protests turn violent across America.
A protest in Philadelphia that started peacefully this afternoon grew violent, a police car burning.
Authorities say they have a plan to deal with these violent outbreaks.
I think that's a categorical mistake because it mislocates violence. In the context of an anti-racist protest in response to yet another police execution of a black man, the background state of affairs is a violence. So if we're going to talk about Antifa bringing any sort of violence at all. I insist that we call it a counter-violence. And I'd even apply that to the very rare moments when mainstream journalists do say the police turned violent. When we see the presence of tear gas wielding baton beating police officers in tanks, people talk about this violent turn in the police. But let's not normalize standard issue police as something non-violent. And then instead of addressing any of the root causes that drive people quite righteously into the streets and into disruptive protest, the Democrats have almost tried to outdo the Republicans in reaffirming themselves as the party of law and order, as if the worst thing in the world is a broken window.
That battle for the narrative of law and order is playing out in U.S. cities, many of which are run by Democrats. The federal government designated multiple major cities, including New York and Seattle, as quote-unquote anarchist jurisdictions, a term that's a bit of an oxymoron and news to the protesters facing police crackdowns in those cities. Meanwhile, the Democrats' presidential candidate Joe Biden is defending himself from a similar accusation, not only being soft on protesters, but actually being Antifa himself.
If you've been online recently, you've probably seen this. If you type Antifa.com into your browser, you go automatically to the Joe Biden for President website.
The rioters and Joe Biden have a side. They're both on the side of the radical left, and that is so obvious.
It was an effort on the Trump campaign that remains pretty strong, even if it's baseless, to say, actually, Joe Biden loves Antifa, loves anarchy, loves uprisings, which obviously for those of us who know anything about Joe Biden close to reality, know it's quite the opposite.
Joe Biden has said as much himself.
You know my heart, you know my story, my family story. Ask yourself, do I look like a radical socialist with a soft spot for rioters?
But right now, it means that the entire fulcrum is about who can be harsher against rightful protest. And I think that's obviously pretty depressing and frightening, given that we're already in a context where anti-protest laws all around the country have been more and more aggressive.
There's a backdrop of more and more mass arrests, more felony rioting charges, and even a Senate hearing arranged by Senator Ted Cruz called Protecting Speech by Stopping Anarchist Violence.
We're seeing signs that a significant portion of this violence, of this rioting, is not random, it's not spontaneous. Rather, it is coordinated and inspired by leftist anarchist groups, groups like Antifa, that will, without shame, exploit a national tragedy to attack American buildings, American homes, and American lives.
So we're seeing, in the context of an already repressive two-dissent government, an out-repression argument in order to garner voters, so there's no one in government who wants to be the kind of stopping point to that.
And it became more frightening when Trump dropped what Natasha refers to as the T word.
So about a few weeks into the anti-racist uprisings this summer, Trump sent out a most Trumpian tweet.
He tweeted, "The United States of America will be designating Antifa as a terrorist organization. These people are anarchists."
Which was problematic in numerous ways. First of all, he actually doesn't have the legal capacity to do that for a number of reasons.
Among those reasons, Natasha points out, there's no way for the U.S. to designate a domestic group as a terrorist organization. And even if it were possible, remember, Antifa isn't a group at all. But that doesn't mean there aren't real consequences for floating the idea.
To name anti-fascism as the ideological enemy of the state is in one way very telling, given the fascistic nature of this state. But it also emboldens the already quite emboldened militia groups to take things into their own hands, because someone has been named not only an enemy, but a terrorist enemy.
But when asked if all of these actions would have a chilling effect on anti-fascist organizing, Natasha's answer was somewhat optimistic.
whether or not this will have a chilling effect, one might think it would, but actually I think we're seeing quite the opposite. I think we're seeing people ever more ready to continue to take to the streets against racism, against fascism. If anything, I think we're seeing people with the most to lose more and more aware that the stakes are high and they're going to keep fighting. And that's, I think, what's so, astounding about this protest moment, this moment of uprisings.
And that's The Take. This episode was produced by Nagin Oliai and Alexandra Locke, with Oni Wohacha, Dina Gispe, Priyanka Tilbe, Amy Walters, Nay Alvarez, and me, Malika Bilal. Alex Roldan was the sound designer. Natalia Aldana is our engagement producer. Stacey Samuel is the executive producer. And Graylin Brashear is head of audio. We'll be back.
Many regions in Canada are entering a second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. Some provinces are restricting social gatherings and asking people to continue working from home if possible. But for some workplaces that are essential for healthcare or our supply chains or the economy, they're under immense pressure to stay open while also keeping their employees safe and preventing outbreaks among their staff. One practical strategy for keeping employees safer is a work bubble strategy. The concept is being used in some businesses, including Bombardier. I'm Dr. Kirsten Patrick, executive editor for the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Jeffrey Shaw and Ms. Haley Wickenheiser, who are two of the authors of an analysis article on working in a bubble. Their article is published in CMAJ. I've reached Haley and Jeff in Calgary. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First, I'm going to ask you to tell us about yourselves. So starting with Haley.
Sure, yeah. So I'm in my final year of medical school at the University of Calgary. And prior to that, I had another life, which was played hockey for 23 years for the Canadian women's national team. So competed in 6 Olympic Games. And now I'm just finishing medicine up. And I'm also an assistant director of player development for the Toronto Maple Leafs.
So you've been really affected by COVID-19 if you're in your final year of med school.
Yeah, it's been very challenging. We were pulled out for 3 months, and it looks like we're not sure what's going to happen moving forward here, but a bit of a precarious situation, yeah.
And Jeffrey, how about you?
Thanks, Kristen. Let me just first say that Haley's quite humble. She also led, I think, Canada's largest PPE driver, was one of the leaders of that, and is an amazing individual, and I'm very happy to be joined here with her today. She is probably the hardest working Canadian I have ever met, but I myself am a cardiologist and ICU doctor out of Calgary. I'm completing currently a fellowship in echocardiography and critical care ultrasound. During the first wave of the pandemic, I was called back to work in the ICU and worked there for 4 weeks and then another additional week after. So I had a chance to see the real effects and seriousness of the COVID-19 outbreak firsthand. At the same time, though, I have several friends who are entrepreneurs. Yeah, I was able to see the effects on business from not only the outbreak, but some of the government restrictions, and watch them make difficult decisions about their employment forces. And so Haley and I and others started having a conversation last spring about what are some ideas that we could develop to try to keep businesses safe, either for the ones that were necessarily open at the time or as further businesses opened up. So that's where we came up with this concept of working bubbles and tried to get the idea out. Honestly, Kirsten, we talked to a bunch of different governments in Canada. We got different feedback from them, all very positive. But what we realized is that they weren't in a position to, you know, provide this to businesses. And so what we decided to do was try to get the idea out in a larger way. So we formed a research team to explore the idea further. And that is ultimately what culminated in this publication. And honestly, me and Haley and a few others started a business as well and created a software solution to try to be able to provide this to businesses. So that's how we kind of got involved with this idea in relation to the pandemic.
That's great background on the article. So Haley, what does it mean actually to work in a bubble?
You know, essentially a work bubble is a concept in which an organization divides their workforce into groups of individuals that are separated from each other and time, space, or maybe both. And really a functional work bubble should have the lowest number of individuals who are required to accomplish the work. That's kind of the essence of it. And they're designed that so that business operations will continue even with the removal of any one bubble from the workforce. So really designed to keep the economy going, which is what we need to have in, of course, in this time of the pandemic. And they should be strictly separated in terms of time, space, or both, eliminating the risk of transmission between the actual work bubbles themselves. And so that can be accomplished by rotating work days or by physical distancing with meticulous decontamination of shared spaces and separating the work bubbles from each other. And then you can also, move individuals between a work bubble, but ideally should be accomplished within a 5-day gap between cluster exposures so that you can match the incubation time of the virus. So, essentially it's a concept which is separating people into groups, time, space, or both, and then being able to track and trace their movements so that if somebody contracts in one bubble, you can knock that bubble out and carry on with the business.
And I think that there are some really novel ways that people are doing that. There are certain work schedules that people have created where individuals, will work Monday to Wednesday, and then another team will come in Thursday, Friday, and pick up Monday again. And people are actually allowing people to come back into the workforce, but in teams that have different days assigned to them or different floors assigned to them, or just separated out a workspace where people are really and truly separated from each other. So there are ways in which people are really creatively dealing with this problem.
This is one of the strengths of this article, is that it's not based in theory and example, but you have also worked out mathematically what the effect of your theory would be, which is useful for policymakers and people in other industries to be able to see that. So your piece focuses on factories and processing plants, particularly using the example of Bombardier. Why are factories and places where people make and pack things a particular problem?
In factories and processing plants, people need to work together, and they need to work together in close proximity. It's not possible to do that type of work from home or to do it separated out when you're making an airplane, for instance, or when you're processing chicken. So it really requires people to work side by side. And what we know about the pandemic, of course, is that being in close proximity with other people for long periods of time is the number one risk factor for spread. And so I think they have particular challenges due to just their work environment and workflow.
In your article, you use the worked example of Bombardier, as I've said before, which is a large Canadian company with many factories and thousands of employees across the country. They implemented the work bubble concept with some success. Can you take us through what they did and what they're still doing?
Absolutely. So at the beginning of the pandemic, they took this very seriously, and they began by implementing a few basic measures and then rapidly some more complex measures. So to begin with, they did things like distancing measures, hand washing stations, PPE, and work from home for the people where that was possible. And then they started integrating cohorting strategies. That first for them looked like separating shifts out. They have shift work at their factories, so they would separate out the shifts so there was no overlap between them. Before, there had been natural overlap, and they just segregated the shifts in time, and so that there was half an hour between them. And now they're moving into an even more vigorous system, which they're trialing, which separates employees out into not only shifts, but physically distanced groups within those shifts. They're conducting symptom screens and monitoring these cohorts of employees to have early warning signs like multiple employees symptomatic within a single work bubble. And so this allows them to know ahead of time who the employee's context will be and to isolate if an employee tests positive the entire cohort. So you can see in this sense, it's a predictive contact tracing system where you know ahead of time who the employee contacts will be. And so if there is a case, you know who to isolate.
So what you're telling me is, even though it's a predictive contact tracing system, it's also a way of limiting spread among an entire workforce. I think that was the idea that you came up with initially. And how does that affect the potential infection curve for the community, for the public at large, and for the business?
Well, we think that there are benefits that extend to the business and to the surrounding community from this concept. A lot of the initial first wave was actually being driven around organizations. And what we saw was there were certain outbreaks that were occurring within organizations that then spread to the larger community. And the risk for that happening is late recognition of an outbreak occurring within an organization. And so if you have a system in place which has the ability to recognize and shut things down quickly, the chance that it spreads to the larger community is lowered. The other reason why it's beneficial for public health is that it's very hard when only, I don't know what it is now, 15 or 20% of Canadians have uptaken the contact tracing app. It's hard to keep up with contact tracing as public health institutions. And so what this also does is allows for businesses to do contact tracing within the business so that when there is a case, they can immediately know the context of that case and are able to share that with public health. And that can help them further manage the outbreak as it may relate to the community as well. In terms of how does it help mitigate organizational spread? Well, we have a model that's produced and demonstrated in the article as well, which really shows that by dividing any organization into groups that are either spatially or temporally isolated from each other, that the chance of spread within that organization is significantly reduced. And it's just common sense that if parts of the organization are actually separated from other parts of the organization, it's not going to be able to spread between those two areas.
It also fosters employee resiliency and employee confidence, I think, when we see the Ontario government has implemented a recommendation of a symptom trace and screen as of September 26th. And so I think many more businesses are going to have something concrete in place to track symptoms and to be able to, trace if something goes wrong. And so I think folks having that peace of mind going into the business that there is some measures in place is also really important, because one of the things that I think we are going to face once the pandemic is over is the fallout on mental health and potentially post-traumatic stress disorder that has incurred in folks that have been faced with this head on.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're an essential worker and you're heading to the coal face, it really helps psychologically if you know that your employers have some strategies to try to keep you safe. So work bubbles have benefits, which you outline well in the article and have done in this podcast, but they also come with challenges. What are the main benefits and corresponding challenges with this sort of process?
I think there's sort of, you could break it down into sort of three categories. So from a public health perspective, we know that bubbles and cohorts can reduce the reproduction number of the disease. They can increase the efficiency and effectiveness of the track and trace systems, and are really a preemptive approach to employee contact tracing that reduces the spread not only within a company, but also in the surrounding community by providing the tool. The difficulty from a public health perspective is that they are difficult to really enforce. And then when you look at employees, some of the advantages is, as we just spoke about, an additional way to protect employees, but also increasing the employee confidence in the safety of the workplace. And then the challenges that come with that is that from a logistics perspective, it might negatively affect the work schedule. Employees might not be able to interact socially with those outside their work bubble. And there may be decreased productivity as, it gets more cumbersome to manage all of this, which I think we are seeing inside of this pandemic. There's a lot of pandemic fatigue that goes into just the protections that have to happen on an everyday basis. And then the last category would be employers. So from an employer benefit, if employment bubbles within a business are modular and redundant, then specific bubbles can be shut down without disruption to the ongoing business operation as a whole, and also allows employers to ensure that they're taking sort of active preventative measures to keep their employees safe. Now, on the challenge side, again, it introduces administrative complexity in the workforce scheduling, and it might be difficult in some cases to ensure separation of work bubbles from one another or from social bubbles. So, it doesn't come without its challenges.
Forced to go toe-to-toe, blow for blow in a war zone with only stones to throw. Vilified by all sides, vilified for small crimes. forced to go blow for blow in a war zone with only stones to throw. Goliath. We're gonna break. We're gonna break. We're gonna break. We're gonna break. The game hasn't changed, same old monopoly. Same couple players on all of the property. I ain't a prop, don't get no props to me. My people still don't eat properly. Think we forgot, we was just property. Think we'll be bought again, think that they brought them democracy. I think they brought back them poppy seeds. My people locked up and chopping. That's hypocrisy, we wasn't thought of. We wasn't brought up and taught, we was set up. That's why we get caught up, y'all discarded us. Put them bars up, of course we got bars up. We hard cause we hard up. They got them startups and Starbucks. We got a couple of stars, so they turn them to starters. They starve us, can't even drink water. Up north with that Flint water, all in the sink. Cause they see for the kids on the brink. Y'all went to Harvard and Stanford. Think harder for answers, man, think. We're far below standards. Don't tell me anger won't help us. You told me the cancer would shrink. We need to shrink. We just see boys making bands and sink. Open your eyes, my fam. We all could be gone in a blink.
19. On doit tous respecter les consignes d'isolement de la santé publique jusqu'au bout. Quand on a des symptômes, on doit s'isoler. Quand on a passé un test, on doit s'isoler. Quand le résultat est positif, on doit s'isoler. Quand on revient de voyage, on doit s'isoler. Et si on a été en contact avec un cas confirmé, on doit s'isoler. S'isoler, c'est sérieux. S'il vous plaît, faites-le. Informations sur québec.ca/isolement. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Time.
C is for...
Cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for...
Kitten.
Cam.
C, wait. Sandroof. C. U. Unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for... Montreal.
Everyone's health is in our hands, now more than ever. The COVID Alert app on my phone notifies me if I've been in contact with someone who recently tested and declared positive. Protecting my health and that of my loved ones is at my fingertips. I can simply download the COVID Alert app, an app that respects my privacy. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-alert to learn how to download the app. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Plus que jamais, la santé de tous est entre nos mains. Sur mon cellulaire, l'application Alerte COVID m'avise si j'ai été en contact avec une personne déclarée positive récemment. Du bout des doigts et dans le respect de ma vie privée, je peux protéger ma santé et celle de mes proches simplement en téléchargeant l'application Alerte COVID.